Well, good morning to you all. It's great to be with you again. I think it's probably true to say that most followers of Jesus in our world today have an uncomfortable relationship with evangelism. They come to Christ, or they're raised to Christ raised in a Christian family, and they have some sense that they're supposed to share the gospel with the world, and it oftentimes just doesn't work out that well. We find ourselves not caring all that much about the world. We find ourselves really incapable of engaging the world with the gospel. We find ourselves intimidated. We're afraid. We don't know how. We have all these questions about evangelism that kind of come rushing at us, and we really don't know how to deal with it. So many of us kind of just throw up our hands and say, well, I guess I'm just not a gifted evangelist, and I guess I'll leave that to somebody else, and maybe there will become some opportunity for me to share Christ with people, and I'll take advantage of that. But often many of us just feel weighed down and guilty about the whole concept of evangelism in the church. We know we're supposed to do it, and yet we don't do it very well. Well, Jesus comes to our aid in Mark chapter 5, verses 1 to 20. I think he is going to help us in many different ways, and one of the things he's going to do is simplify it for us. One of the things we've done with evangelism, I think, is we made it way too complicated, much more complicated than it has to be, trying to analyze all the nuances of our world and then try to address the nuances of our world with some particular approach or some particular formula. Jesus is going to simplify evangelism for us. He's going to give us, each of us, something that we can do that may require a little bit of courage, but it's something that all of us can do, whether or not you understand yourself to be a gifted evangelist. So turn with me to Mark chapter 5, verses 1 to 20. If you remember last week, if you were with us last week, we saw that Jesus undertook this mission to go to the other side of the Sea of Galilee to bring the gospel into Gentile country on the eastern shore. Up to this point, he's been concentrating on the western side of the Sea of Galilee, Jewish country. Now he's going to the world, and he's bringing his disciples with him. So he faced a fearsome threat as he was crossing the sea. A fierce storm overtook the boat. The boat began to be swamped with water, and the disciples were bailing, and they're worried about Jesus, and why doesn't Jesus do anything about this? And Jesus wakes up, and he calms the storm. So that was the first threat that this mission to the world faced. And now as Jesus comes ashore with his disciples, he is going to face another fearsome threat. We're going to look at this story in two parts. First of all, the confrontation that Jesus has with this fearsome foe, and then the aftermath of that confrontation. So first of all, Mark chapter 5, verses 1 to 13. They went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills he would cry out and cut himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Swear to God that you won't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you evil spirit." Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many." And he begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area. A large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demons begged Jesus, "Send us among the pigs. Allow us to go into them." He gave them permission, and the evil spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. Very strange story. Let's see if we can make some sense of it. So this man is possessed by an unclean spirit. As the story unfolds, we understand that more than one unclean spirit possesses him, but this is his plight, to be possessed by evil to some degree. He lives among the tombs. The tombs were sometimes appropriated by the poor or the disenfranchised, and they would live there in isolation. So this man lives in isolation from the community. There's really no place for him in the city. They've banished him, and so he lives in isolation, a real painful, isolated existence. He has supernatural strength because of the presence of these demons. He cries out day and night in his agony and in his pain. He cuts himself. This is the only relief he seems to be able to find for his difficult existence, for his painful existence. He gashes himself with stones. He is depicted in Mark's gospel very much like the storm from the previous passage. In the previous passage, it was said that literally a great wind came about. And this man literally cries out greatly night and day. So the storm and the man are depicted by Mark in very similar terms. Well, this man provides for us a picture of our world which is in pain. Many people in our world live as if they were men from the tombs. They live in isolation, not being really able to connect with one another. And this is oftentimes what our modern Western world does. It isolates isolates us from one another. And the relationships that we hunger for and want most often elude us, and we live in isolation. Many people in our world cry out day and night, oftentimes for the world to hear, but more often silently. These silent screams of torment, of these people who really want something out of life and aren't getting it and feel that they are living in isolation and they want so much more. There's so much pain in their lives that they just want to scream oftentimes. Sometimes, particularly among the young, this results in cutting yourself, actually literally cutting yourself, as this man cut himself. And sometimes this is the thing that brings the relief, at least the temporary relief, from all of the pain in life. You take a blade or some other device and you cut yourself and you bleed. And that provides temporary relief for the pain in your life. Of course, it provides also long-term agony. Many people live as if they were the storm. There's this storm that has twisted their personality and they can't really be who they want to be. The man from the tombs is a picture of our world. So we are supposed to, in this passage, see in the man from the tombs a picture of our world. And the passage invites us to care for the world, to be moved by this picture, to see a world in pain and say, maybe I should do something about it. A man by the name of Lord Shaftesbury, he came on the heels of William Wilberforce in 19th century England as a social reformer. He attempted to take on the abuses of the Industrial Revolution. He was a devoted follower of Jesus and a social reformer. And this is what he said to a friend, very interesting, near the end of his life. He said this, "When I feel old age creeping upon me and know that I must soon die, I hope it is not wrong to say it, I cannot bear to leave this world with all the misery in it." Now, that's a different perspective, isn't it? You think that you wouldn't want to leave this world because there's some kind of joy in this world that you want to experience. This man said, I don't want to leave it because of all of the misery in the world that I care for. I care for the people in misery in this world, so I want to stay in this world absolutely as long as possible to address it. It's that kind of heart that this passage would instill in us. It is that kind of heart that this passage would challenge us to think about having for our world in pain. So here in our passage, we have two kingdoms in conflict. Two kingdoms collide on the shore of Galilee. And this fearsome foe comes rushing toward Jesus. And we get the impression from the narrative that we would expect this man to attack Jesus. Instead, he is rushing toward Jesus with all of this strength, with all of this power. And what does he do? He doesn't attack Jesus. He bows down before Jesus. He recognizes that he is in the presence of a greater power. And in the course of his interaction with Jesus, he confesses that his name is Legion. There's actually more than one unclean spirit possessing this man. It is a legion of demons. And a legion could comprise up to thousands of individuals, thousands of troops in a Roman army. And even this legion has to submit to Jesus. Even this legion perceives from afar that it is in the presence of a greater power and has to submit to Jesus. Well, there's this interaction between Legion and Jesus eventually casts out the demons and he sends them into the pigs according to the request of the demons, and the pigs are drowned in the sea. Now, what are we to make of this? Well, this constitutes an observable victory over the demons. So you could see that God is conquering evil because of what happened to the pigs. It would also serve as a word of encouragement to the man who would know now that he is completely released from those unclean spirits that had been tormenting him. And what also happens here is, because this is a pagan land and they would use pigs in the course of their ritual sacrifices, what is happening is that Jesus is cleansing the land of idolatry, because the pigs would be used in pagan sacrifices. So Jesus calms the storm in this man. This storm that had invaded his life and twisted his personality, Jesus calms it. So our world, like this man, is in the clutches of the evil one. Satan enslaves people in our world to the dark spiritual powers of this world, to the dark economic forces of this world, to the dark political powers of this world. Our world is in torment. Our world is being tortured just like this man. And we are up against a fearsome foe, Satan, the evil one, who has taken over this man's life. Who are we to think that we can take on such a foe, such a fearsome, powerful foe? It all concerns what we actually believe. The man, even from afar, possessed by the demons, could perceive that Jesus was the Son of the Most High God. What is it that we actually believe about Jesus? He is the Son of the Most High God. So that's what we need to believe. And if we believe that, if we believe that he is more powerful than anything else in this world, any opposing force, then we have the courage and the power to go into this world, bringing with us the power of the Son of the Most High God. Don't be intimidated. Don't be fearful. Do not fear where you tread. The power of the Son of the Most High God is with you wherever you go. So we believe in the power of the Son of the Most High God. Now, the people in this story were unable to bind this man, and no one was strong enough to restrain him. Now, if you read the Gospel of Mark carefully, you will go back to Mark chapter 3 and kind of this parable that Jesus told when he was challenged by the Pharisees. And he said that he essentially goes into the strong man's house, that is Satan, and he binds him in order to set the captives free, in order to plunder Satan and release those who had been held captive. He is the one who is strong enough to go into Satan's house and plunder the plunder his property, release the captives. And so he asks us to do that as well, to go into the strong man's house and release the captives by his power. Now, it is one thing for us to assent to the lordship of Jesus Christ and simply believe it on an intellectual level. It is quite another thing to believe in the lordship of Jesus Christ to such an extent that you raid enemy territory. And this is a passage that would encourage us and challenge us to go into enemy territory and raid it, set the captives free, plunder the strong man's house. Make no mistake about it, brothers and sisters, we are in a war. We may be uncomfortable with that kind of language, but that's the kind of language that the scriptures use to describe what we are in. The church is not a cruise ship. Oftentimes it is depicted as such, as the church being a cruise ship, kind of meeting all of your needs. All of the goods and services are provided for you to make your life easy. The church is not a cruise ship, it is a battleship. And we are called to take on the evil one in this world for the sake of Jesus Christ. Let us make sure, however, that we are fighting the right enemy. Let's think about this story. Let's think about the backstory again. What's going on here? Okay, we've got some pigs that drown in the sea. Does that ring a bell for anybody? Something drowning in the sea. You got to go back to Exodus, right? I take a lot of lumps for this. I always have to work the Exodus into a sermon, but here it is. You get it once again. What happens in the Exodus? Who drowns in the Exodus? It is the Romans, the enemies of the... Not the Romans, it is... Oh, it is the Egyptians. They are the ones who drown in the sea. Now you move forward to the first century, and if you're a Jew, who do you want to drown in the sea? You want the Romans to drown in the sea. You want the Romans to be pushed back, not to the Sea of Galilee, but all the way to the Mediterranean. So much the better if they were to drown there. Cleanse this land of these Roman swine. Instead of taking on the Romans, what does Jesus do? He looks behind the enemy to see the real enemy. It is Satan who has taken over Israel, who has taken over the world, and Jesus is doing battle with the evil one himself. Here's the new Exodus. The old Exodus, you got Gentiles who are drowning. In the new Exodus, you have a Gentile who's liberated by Jesus. So our objective, brothers and sisters, is not to push back the liberals to the sea. Our objective is not to push back the conservatives to the sea. Our objective is not to advance the cause of Western-style democracy. Our objective is not to advance the cause of whatever identity group you happen to be a part of, be it ethnic, generational, or gender-based, or whatever. Our objective is to enter the world, the places of our world where evil holds sway, and bring to those places the loving, healing influence of the gospel of Jesus Christ. That is our objective. Let us also make sure, however, that we are employing the right weapons. Not weapons of the flesh, but weapons of the Spirit, which include and feature primarily prayer and the Word of God. Let us act lovingly, compassionately, yet boldly for the sake of our world. And let us do so while we are praying, and praying ceaselessly, bringing the influence of the gospel to the world as we are praying every step of the way. Along the way, we will watch a few demons go down and a few tortured souls rise from the tomb. At this point, the iconic words of Hudson Taylor are appropriate. He said this, the great missionary to China, and what's happening in China today, the Olympics is one thing, what's happening for the gospel there is quite another. It's absolutely astounding what is happening for the sake of the gospel in China this day. It doesn't get in a lot of press, but it probably goes back to some degree to this man, Hudson Taylor. God's work done in God's way will never lack God's supplies. God's work, bringing the influence of the gospel to the world, done in God's way, using weapons of the Spirit, not weapons of the flesh, will never lack God's supplies. It will always be accompanied by the power of the Son of the Most High God. Now, this narrative is quite fascinating when you put the whole narrative of the Gospel of Mark together, because this man is depicted in a manner similar to the way Mark depicts Jesus in his crucifixion and in his resurrection. There's isolation here in this story. Jesus is isolated on the cross. There is nakedness in this story. There is nakedness in the crucifixion story as well. All sorts of connections exist between these two stories. And if you get to the end, if you paid attention, you're able to put those two stories together and realize that Jesus' story is bound together with this man's story in a very profound way, and that his healing takes place primarily not here as Jesus casts out the demons, but his healing takes place primarily on the cross. And so if we are followers of the Lord Jesus Christ, our story is intimately bound together with the story of the world, which features the pain of the world. So the story of the church is bound together with the pain of the world, just as Jesus' story was bound together with the pain of this man. So we see from verses 1 through 13 that we have a world that is in pain, and yet we have the power of the Son of the Most High God to address a world in pain. Mark chapter 5, verses 14 to 20. Now we see the aftermath of this incredible confrontation. Those tending the pigs ran off and reported this in the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. Then the people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Jesus did not let him, but said, "Go home to your family and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and all the people were amazed. So the locals are impressed by the power of Jesus, but they are concerned because they think that he might be nothing more than a wonder worker who has the capacity to wreak havoc with their economic and religious systems. Their economic system was dependent on pigs for food and whatnot. Their religious system was also dependent on pigs for ritual sacrifices. So somebody who messes with that, well, they ask him to leave their region. Jesus, strangely enough, complies. We want you to leave. Jesus says, okay, the power of the most, he is the Son of the Most High God with all this power, yet he leaves. And then the man who Jesus has just helped has a request as well. The man implores Jesus that he might follow Jesus, that he might go with Jesus as Jesus leaves the region, as Jesus is getting in the boat. Jesus, interestingly enough, denies the request. No, you don't come with me. So let's put the whole story together, all of these requests that are made of Jesus, and let's see if we can get this straight. The unclean spirits ask that they might stay in the region, and Jesus complies. The residents ask Jesus to leave the region, and Jesus complies. The new follower of Jesus asks that he might follow Jesus wherever he goes, wherever he's going next, and Jesus says no. Everyone in this story gets what they want. All of the opponents in this story get what they want, except for the one follower of Jesus. He doesn't get what he wants. What gives? Well, what's Jesus doing? He goes to the region, he leaves the region, but in a sense, he doesn't leave the region because he leaves behind a preacher. He tells this man, now you go into your land and you tell people the great things that the Lord has done for you. And the man complies, generating a response of amazement. So Jesus' dangerous mission to the other side of the lake is for one person. All of this trouble, all of these problems, all of this stuff that could happen to Jesus and his disciples, all this stuff that did happen, they risked it all for one individual person to set one man free. But what does this man do? He tells his story. He stays behind in his home, in his region, and he goes about evangelizing this region. Now, if you fast forward in the Gospel of Mark, you come back in Mark chapter 6, Jesus returns to this region. It is different. There is a different reception. They are welcoming him. Implications? This man did something. This man did his job. He went into that region and he told people how much the Lord had done for him. So many people in our world are like the locals in this story. They see evidence of Jesus. They see evidence of Jesus working in his people, and yet the question of Jesus' identity never really rises to the surface. They never allow themselves to seriously entertain whether Jesus is the Son of the Most High God in a way that would cause them to submit to Jesus. They don't invite him to stay. And why is that? The narrative suggests that for some people, Jesus constitutes a threat. Inviting Jesus to stay would threaten their hopes for economic prosperity. Inviting Jesus to stay would threaten their whole view of spirituality, which is usually conceived to make them successful, which is usually conceived of to make themselves feel good about themselves. In our world today, one of our lords is the economy, and those who promise to fix it are our high priests. The mantra for the modern political campaign is this: it's the economy, stupid. That's the mantra. Stay on message. Preach the economy if you're trying to get elected. Preach that you're going to fix the economy if you're trying to get elected. Well, there's not much room for Jesus in such a world unless you try to get Jesus, unless you co-opt Jesus so that he's going to service your economic dreams. So he's going to service your economic system. And many people do. Many people who supposedly teach the Bible do that. They try to make you think that what Jesus is going to do is going to make you realize your economic dreams, your dreams of prosperity. The Bible will have none of it. Jesus, of course, himself will have none of it. So Jesus is the Son of the Most High God, the most powerful presence in the world. But there is another power at play here, beyond the power of Satan. It's the power that you have. And what is that power? It's the power to send Jesus packing. The locals ask Jesus to leave. Jesus, the Son of the Most High God, agrees. Jesus is not going to foist himself on anyone. With all of this power, the power to heal people, the power to cast out demons, the power to heal the sick, the power in our next passage to even raise the dead, with all of this power, it is you who have the power whether or not you want to accept Jesus or whether or not you want to send him packing. He grants you that power. It's amazing. That's what Jesus does, and he gives us the power to welcome him into our lives or to send him packing. To send him packing, to break his heart, to destroy yourself, or to welcome him, to invite him, and to have yourself reconstituted as a human, to have the Lord really remake you so that you might serve his purposes. But be forewarned, if you invite Jesus into your life, if you want him to stay around, he is going to confound your expectations. Everybody in this story gets what they want except the follower of Jesus. Even the opponents of Jesus get what they want. The follower of Jesus doesn't get what he wants. Have you ever felt that way? Have you ever felt as if everyone around you is getting what he or she wants except for you? Have you ever felt that even the wicked are prospering, even the wicked are getting what they want, except the door that you really want open, Jesus seems to be closing? Well, when that happens, watch for the door that he opens. Watch for the door that Jesus opens that you never in a million years would have conceived of. You couldn't have dreamed it. You couldn't have imagined it. Watch for the door that Jesus opens and then walk through that door and see if you don't bear fruit 30, 60, and a hundredfold. See if what happens is you realize dreams that you couldn't dream, because Jesus knows exactly what you need, exactly where you need to go, and it's a door that only you can walk through. Look what happened to this man. He walked through this door. He didn't get what he wanted, but he stayed behind and did what Jesus told him, and he realized a bountiful harvest. So, how does Jesus simplify evangelism for us? He tells us to do this: tell others how much the Lord has done for you. That's it. There's no take a class. There's no read a book. There's no go to the local seminary. There's not even any read the Bible in here. Now, all of those things are good things to do, but Jesus doesn't tell him to do any of those things. He simply says, go into your world and tell your world how much the Lord has done for you. This is the most powerful testimony of all. The most powerful witness that you have to give to your world is what Jesus has done for you. That's it. That's the most powerful thing. And by the way, Jesus doesn't say, go and convert anyone. He says, tell. Don't convert, tell. Conversion is the job of the Holy Spirit. Telling is your job. Simply go into the world, go into your world, the people you know, the people you meet, and tell people what the Lord has done for you. That's it. Simple. Okay? Yes, there could be more to it than that, but that's what the passage gives us. And everybody can do it. Now, you're afraid to do that, aren't you? You're afraid just to kind of go up and introduce yourself to people, or afraid to introduce the Lord into your whole conversation. Let me see if we can work with this a little bit. First of all, I notice sometimes in the church that we're even uncomfortable sometimes talking about Jesus in the church in a personal way. We're more than happy to pray for Aunt Martha, but sometimes we don't really talk about what's on our hearts. We don't really talk about what Jesus is doing in our hearts or what he's not doing. We're not talking about sometimes in a profound way or even in casual ways, simply about what's happening between the Lord and us. How we're praying, what the Lord is showing us, what he's not showing us, how we're confused about him, how we're not confused, all of these things. First of all, then, introduce all of this into your normal, everyday interactions with people in the church. Start talking to people in the church about what Jesus has done for you. Start talking to people in the church about what the Lord is doing for you. Now, first step now, to go outside the church, in the people that you know, family members perhaps, co-workers, fellow students, other interactions. Okay, now what are you going to do? Here's what I suggest. Don't edit yourself. I noticed some years ago that here was what I was doing. I was very free among believers talking about what the Lord was showing me. And then when I was interacting with people who I didn't think were believers, I would come short and I would try to find different language to try to communicate with them what was happening that kind of circumvented the Lord. This was a very unnatural thing to do. I was editing myself. So now with the people in your world, after you become comfortable relating to people in the church by telling them what the Lord is doing for you, go into your world and don't edit. Don't edit. This is the most natural thing in the world to do then. The unnatural thing to do is to edit. That's what I was doing. And now much more regularly, much more frequently, and casually, when I see that happening in me, I let it go. I mean, I just let it rip, and I say, the Lord's doing this. I get some weird looks sometimes. Eyebrows get raised. But what is it that we are afraid of? Don't be intimidated, brothers and sisters in Christ. The power of the Son of the Most High God is with you. Go forward. Tell them what the Lord is doing for you. Even in just casual interactions, just work the Lord into it in a very natural way. Who knows but that a simple word might grow in someone's heart like a mustard seed to bloom and blossom like a mighty tree. And who knows but that a simple word might go into someone's heart and bloom and blossom and take over an entire region. So we have a world that is in pain. Our passage invites us to care about this world in pain. We have with us, in order to address the pain of the world, the power of the Son of the Most High God, and we have a command. Go into the world and tell the world the great things that the Lord has done for you. Whether or not we respond to this whole passage, whether we respond to the command to go into the world to tell people what the Lord has done for us, may hinge on whether or not we see in the man from the tombs a picture not only of our world, but a picture of ourselves. Because we too were deeply afflicted, and perhaps we still are deeply afflicted. We too were in pain. Yes, we still are in pain, but Jesus has done something for us. We are the man from the tombs. Listen to C.S. Lewis, speaking of his own conversion. For the first time I examined myself with a seriously practical purpose, and there I found what appalled me, a zoo of lusts, a bedlam of ambitions, a nursery of fears, a harem of fondled hatreds. My name was Legion. See? My name was Legion too. Your name was Legion as well. Perhaps our name still is Legion. But Jesus has entered our lives. Jesus has healed us, not completely, but he has given us something for our pain. He has showed us a different way of looking at the world. He has shown us a different way of looking at ourselves. He has shown us a different way of looking at God. He has restored to us our humanity. Yes, we still have pain, but it is pain with life. It is pain with hope, and it is pain that identifies with the pain of the world. It is pain with freedom. It is pain with passion. It is pain with love. How much the Lord has done for you. How he has had mercy on you. So the man went away and began to tell in Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him.